You can argue quite readily that you can never master tennis. And I think that'd probably be pretty true. I mean, we all know the unforced error is part of our lives. But I think Roger really, you know, came as close to anyone to mastering the craft, both with his technique and the way he connected with the game on a larger level. I think that's what made it sort of the perfect storm in terms of a great match. But Rafa had to adjust his game, get closer to the baseline to challenge Roger, had to change some of his technique, improve his serve, work on his forecourt game. So all those things had to happen. And that's the beauty of this era, Patrick, because these guys all were able to go to heights they could never have reached on their own because of the guys who were around them. On a global level, Roger just hits certain chords. You know, for me, I thought a lot about it, obviously, covering him all those years. And when I tried to do the book, the best I could do it, I really wanted to be able to answer that question. You know, why? Why is there this such a strong connection that he's established? And I kind of centered in, I'd say, I think on three things.
Hi again, everyone. This is Patrick McEnroe, president of the International Tennis Hall of Fame, and very proud to be hosting the Tennis Worthy podcast. And today we have something extra special for you. We know about great champions in tennis. We know about legendary players. We know about generational talent all in the Hall of Fame. And then there are masters. And that is going to be the topic of our discussion today. One of the most elegant, transformative players to ever grace the sport of tennis. The one and only Roger Federer. But this is really a special treat because we get to talk to the man, Christopher Clary, who has been covering Roger, has covered Roger throughout his entire career, working many years with the New York Times. And he wrote a book on Roger called The Master. And we are proud to have you here, Chris, to talk about this. And we had tickets go on sale just recently for the induction weekend. And suffice to say, this is a pretty hot ticket, and you know why. Thank you for joining us, and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Patrick. It's great to be with you. And it's a little strange always because, I mean, I interviewed you for so many years out there on the circuit, both as a player and then as a Davis Cup captain. So it's always a little odd to suddenly be the one receiving the questions, but I think I can handle it. We'll see how it goes.
I think you can. And again, I appreciate you doing this for the Hall of Fame. Why the name Master when you came up with the title for your book on Roger?
Yeah, we talked about that a lot. I mean, it's obviously so many ways you can go with that. And I just felt like we wanted something timeless. And I just felt like with our publisher that Roger was, he was a craftsman and an artist. And I think that just the master captures that in a lot of ways. And you can argue quite readily that you can never master tennis. And I think that'd probably be pretty true. I mean, we all know the unforced error is part of our lives. But I think Roger really, you know, came as close to anyone to mastering the craft, both with his technique and the way he connected with the game on a larger level.
Do you consider mastery to be different than dominance?
You know, I think so. I mean, I think there's a certain element of mental game and dominance, perhaps, and maybe some coincidence in there as well, in terms of how your era stacks up, who you're facing, and mastery is more of an internal thing for me. It's sort of how you approach your technique, your game, and you know, controlling your own emotions and controlling yourself. And one of the most interesting things about Roger, which I'm sure we'll talk about today, is how he was able to master himself over time from a tough spot from the beginning in many ways.
Yeah, let's start there because I think you know, you were there right from the beginning when he was a teenager. I actually remember as being the Davis Cup captain, the first match I had as a captain was in Switzerland, and it was a teenage Roger Federer. And I remember, you know, he dominated the singles matches, but what I remember most about that, Chris, was the way he dominated the doubles court, and he would hit these cut volleys and the ball would literally just die with the spin. And I was like watching, you know, my brother had some pretty good volleys, and I was watching this guy, and I was like, this guy's doing something different to the ball that I've never seen done. But let's talk about the emotional side first, because I think, you know, you talk about it quite a bit in your book that Roger had to sort of master his own temperament early on. And what were your memories of that?
You know, I wasn't around to see Roger when he was 12, 13, 14. The first time I saw him play was in person was, you know, early in his beginning of his Grand Slam career at the French Open, 99. And that was still a little scratchy in terms of the behavior and the temper and things like that. And I was with you in Basel. You may not remember, but I was there for that and for your debut. And I came to write about your debut as captain and ended up writing a lot about Roger Federer. No offense to you. It was just one of those things you couldn't ignore. And it was one of the times when it was just clear from watching the guy play that he was going to win majors and do great things in the game. And I'm not a big prediction guy, but I felt like he was going to be number one in the world from watching the way he played against you all that, you know, that long weekend. But as far as Roger's development goes, it's interesting, Patrick, because when I go around the world and talk tennis with people, many people don't recall this or don't know this still, that Roger Federer was a hothead and kind of a self-loathing, classic, you know, temperamental tennis player when he was a teen. You know, easy. We all know he was somebody who was, tears were, came easily to him in emotions after matches, but he kept so much under wraps during his prime years. And part of the reason he succeeded was he was able to control these demons within him. And I don't think you really can overestimate the evolution there. It was something that was really, really tough for him. And you talk to people early on in his career who coached him closely, people who really saw all the talent and all the ability that he had. That was clear from a very young age in Switzerland when he was working with Peter Carter, and later on when he moved to the Swiss Training Center near Lake Geneva, working with Christoph Freiss and people like that. Everybody could see what he had. But really, the jury was out if Roger would be able to manage his emotions and be able to control himself, because he would lose so many matches because he would have a temper fit, or he'd check his racket, or he'd start to get frustrated when he was in control, as so many players do. He wasn't able to accept his own mistakes. So to be able to shake free of that and to control that, certainly it was some natural maturity that happened there, but it was a very active thing. And he sought help from a sports psychologist. All of his coaches focused on it. But ultimately, the change had to come from him. And it came relatively late. I don't think it was until 2003, the year he won his first major at Wimbledon, that he was really able to finally put some of that to rest and be able to really control the emotions. It snuck out once in a while, you know, as you saw over the years, but hardly ever.
Do you think that it was, there was a one, you mentioned quite a few of his coaches and people that he worked with in his younger years. Do you think there was one person specifically that helped him, you know, the most with that? Or was it just kind of like, as you said, you know, partly him growing up and partly him recognizing himself that he had to get this under control if he wanted to kind of become the master that he ended up becoming?
Yeah, I mean, I think Christian Marcoli, who was his performance psychologist from age 16 to 18, played a big role. And Christian will tell you, he didn't solve it. It was still an issue when they finished. But Roger was reluctant to do that and seek that kind of help. And honestly, when Roger was 16, it was, you know, much less common on tour for players to seek that out in some sort of formal way. And Roger never really liked talking about that part of it too much, but I know it was an important thing for him, and it really taught him. Roger, I think, was somebody overflowing with energy, nervous energy. You talk to people who coached him early. It was hard to keep his focus on a conversation sometimes, which is sort of hard to believe now looking at him communicate, but it's true. And he's had energy overflowing, and sometimes his coaches would say it was better to talk to him while he was moving. So I think he got very easily distracted by his own play and what was happening around him in matches. So one of the things I know Marcoli worked with him about was controlling where his gaze was, keeping his eyes very much on the strings, which you'll see him do during matches if you go back and watch, or keeping his eyes out of the stands, just trying to stay very focused on the task at hand, which sounds straightforward, but really isn't. And that was sort of the first step. They talked a lot about his own emotional state during matches, how he would handle ups and downs. But that was sort of the start of it. And I think ultimately, you know, Peter Lundgren, you know, the late Peter Lundgren, who coached Roger during his early years on tour, critical formative years, also played a role. Peter was, as you know well, a pretty cool dude. Definitely somebody who was chill, which Roger was not at that stage in many ways. And I know he and, you know, Peter and Roger talked a lot about those things. But ultimately, it came down, I think, to the image that Roger wanted to project to the world about himself and about his game. And he talked to me about a match against Safin. I think it was in Rome when they were just throwing rackets and yelling and going back and forth. And Roger watched, you know, footage of this on Eurosport and suddenly realized, wow, that's how I'm going to be portrayed and how I'll be perceived around the world. And he knew he was going to be great. How great, he didn't know, but he could see it was coming. And I think he knew then that he'd had enough of the tools in place to be able to manage it. But he did it by locking down. I mean, Roger, the Zen master mask that he wore, Patrick, that was not Roger on the inside, at least not at the beginning.
Christopher Clary joining me here on the Tennis Worthy podcast. And, you know, I remember one specific player was Leighton Hewitt that, you know, is a Hall of Famer himself, was number one, you know, just before Roger sort of took that over, 03, 04. 04 is when Federer became number one. You mentioned Wimbledon, his first major. But I remember when he first was on the tour, he struggled against Hewitt. And partly, I think the reason he struggled is because Hewitt was such a great counterpuncher, and Roger would just try to go through him. You know, he'd try to play offense. And I remember one match, I think it was in Cincinnati. I was working for ESPN covering, and I remember Roger just going into like a, you mentioned lockdown, going into a lockdown mode the way he played. In other words, he would play more defense against Hewitt. And I don't know if something clicked in his head or maybe because he got fitter, you know, he worked on his fitness a lot. But it seemed to me when he realized that he could pretty much do anything, and all of a sudden Hewitt had no idea what to do because Roger just sort of kind of slowballed him a little bit. And then, you know, he would take offense when it was there. But I felt that when he first came on the tour, he would just try to play offense all the time. And when he figured out, wow, I can just kind of, you know, slice the ball, I can loop the ball a little bit more, it seemed to me that that's when he started to realize just how good he could get.
I think that's a great comment. Yeah, it was a complete package. And I think part of the challenge with Leighton, let's not forget, was a true prodigy and really achieved so much as a teenager. He hit number one in the world and things like that that Roger didn't do, was those guys go way back. Not just face-to-face, but in each other's minds because they're contemporaries. And they first played each other when they were both 15 in a European junior event. Darren Cahill was there for that. And so was Peter Carter, who was coaching Roger at the time. And it was evidently like a swear fest, a racket throwing fest, temperamental, but there was genius on the court. And these guys just wound each other up. And obviously Roger heard loads about Leighton from Peter Carter, whose coach, who was an Australian, you know, from Adelaide, who knew Leighton. And then Leighton heard plenty about Roger from Darren Cahill. So it was just a match that sort of started this thing off. And ultimately, if you go back and watch those early matches on the tour between Leighton and Roger, which I did for the book that I wrote, and I watched them, of course, in real time back in the day, they kind of gotten lost over the years with the, you know, focus on the big three and everything else. Great tennis. Really, truly holds up very, very well. I mean, the Shanghai final 2002 ATP finals there, Roger just, you know, found new gears in his game. And you're right. I think he realized ultimately, I think he wanted it maybe a little too much early on against Leighton because of that background and history to it. And he did realize over time that he could play many different ways and on whatever the surface might be. And that was the key to his longevity and his longer success. Because the man, even though you couldn't see it on your television screen, so quick, so fast. I remember James Blake telling me, Patrick, at Basel, at the Davis Cup you mentioned, what struck James watching from the sideline as a practice partner that week. He goes, when Roger got a forehand, once he got control of the point, you couldn't get it to his backhand again. He was that quick.
Interesting. You mentioned the big three, so I think we could go there. You also just, Chris, also just put out a book recently on Rafael Nadal, which is just above him if you're watching on video. But you can get that book as well, which really focuses on Rafa's domination, particularly in Paris. But let's talk about, you know, that rivalry and how it started. You mentioned those, you know, 03, 04, you know, 04 to 06, with those 3 years where Roger, I think he lost 4, 6, and 5 matches in those 3 years, each of those years. And obviously Rafa was coming along there, you know, starting to dominate at Roland Garros, which is what that book's about. But, you know, let's kind of fast forward that to when, you know, they played their epic final at Wimbledon. Was Rafa was sort of catching up to Roger on the grass. And it finally happened in that epic match. So just kind of, it felt like a little bit of a recalibration maybe of the rivalry as that happened. How did you see it from your eyes over those years covering it?
Yeah. I mean, for Roger still is the man at Wimbledon, the 8 titles, it's a record and it should be. And that really was Roger's happiest hunting ground in many ways. I mean, he won the U.S. Open 5 times in a row, which hasn't been matched either, but it's something I think that will go on. I'm not sure Novak will get another one. So we'll see. But I think
he's still trying. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you can't count him out after what we saw in Australia for sure. But I do feel like for all the great rivalries Roger had with, you know, Novak and other players, the Rafa rivalry, 40 matches, will be what defines, you know, him over time in many ways. And it was a rivalry right from the start. People forget. First time they ever played in singles, 2004 Miami. Roger had just gone to number one in the world, and Rafa was not a known quantity yet at that point for a lot of people outside the real elite of the game, and rocks up in Miami, and Rafa beats him in straight sets, playing a lot of the patterns on a hard court that would end up being their patterns over time. So Roger knew right from the beginning what he was facing. And he hadn't really been on top of the game very long. And I'm sure there was a little bit of, quiet resentment about that, because suddenly Roger's built his game. It's all coming together for him mentally and physically. And suddenly here's this force of nature from Mallorca who emerges. And, first time I ever saw Nadal was at Wimbledon. So I saw him play live on an outside court. And you could just tell him, hey, there's a lot of Spaniards say, grass is for cows, but Rafa loves soccer, and you play soccer on what? So you could just tell the guy felt comfortable on the grass from the beginning, had this natural, killer instinct and exuberance that I've never seen in any other player, to be honest. And he just really rose to the occasions. And I think he got from the very beginning when he came to Wimbledon as a junior, he had it in his mind that he wanted to win it. And he ran up against probably the greatest grass court player, of all time, you could argue. And so what it took for Rafa to be able to extract that from himself and really challenge Roger on that surface was an extraordinary act of will as well as talent. But to Roger's credit, he held him off at Wimbledon in those key years for such a long time. And I guess the 2008 masterpiece that Nadal won in the darkness there, the groundwork for that was laid in 2007 when Roger won a very, very tight five-set match. And Rafa ends up in tears, as he describes, underneath a shower, sobbing after that match because he felt he didn't quite give all that he had. So all these things come together, and then the 2008 French Open final where Roger just gets destroyed by Nadal on clay, and maybe Nadal's most perfect match, not his favorite match, but maybe his most perfect match. That kind of laid the groundwork for Roger's vulnerability at Wimbledon. But you can see it building. The great thing about that 2008 match, as I'm sure you remember, was that it was hyped up beyond belief and it actually surpassed the expectations. How often does that happen? So I think that's what made it sort of a perfect storm in terms of a great match. But Rafa had to adjust his game, get closer to the baseline to challenge Roger, had to change some of his technique, improve his serve, work on his forecourt game. So all those things had to happen. And that's the beauty of this era, Patrick, because these guys all were able to go to heights they could never have reached on their own because of the guys who were around them.
Because Federer was so elegant to watch and so graceful the way he played, a lot of people, sort of were under the impression it's so easy for him and he doesn't put in the same intense effort that Nadal does, right? You can see it in the way Rafa plays. What did you see in your years and then and covering the book that told a different story?
Yeah, I mean, I one of my main themes in writing the book was that, Roger was beautiful to watch, but the man, he had grit. He definitely had much more grit than you'd ever suspect. And there's some proof in the numbers. I know you know this, but over 1,000 singles matches on tour, never retired from a single one.
Right. Yeah.
And didn't retire from doubles either. He had one retirement way back in the Challenger days. Maybe it was the Futures, but never on the main tour. And that's very impressive. No other player in the history of elite tennis at that top level has ever had that kind of stat with that kind of longevity. But then you have to realize that Roger was a master as well at hiding his injuries. He was somebody who was hurting, certainly not as often as Nadal, but plenty of times. He had a back problem from a pretty early age, had problems with hips and knees and different things over the years. But because of the way he played, because of the stroke production, and because of that underrated internal strength in Roger, you hardly ever knew. There were times in matches when he was really just grinding it out, stiff as could be, and often you didn't know. I mean, just go to the last match he ever played at Wimbledon against Hubert Hurkacz. Loses the third set, 6-love. Yes, you knew he was diminished by what would turn out to be the knee problems that would ultimately end his career. But if you were watching, as I was, and you watched him move, he could still flow. He could still do things. So Roger's toughness was not immediately apparent. But if you look at the body of work, so very clear. And also the resilience after big blows to the resume and to the ego. Some of those defeats that he experienced were just brutal, including that 2008 Wimbledon final we already talked about. What happened the next year? Wins the French Open, wins Wimbledon, beating Andy Roddick in a classic nail-biter of a match. So Roger for all the smoothness and elegance and ultimately eloquence that he had, smooth talker too by the end of his career. So much grit in there as well.
Yeah, a lot of resilience. And I think to your earlier point, you know, the big three and others, you know, Andy Murray and Stan Wawrinka, who Roger won the gold medal with in doubles, representing Switzerland, they pushed each other. They learned from each other. Djokovic, you know, now has the most majors of the three of them. How about that rivalry and how that began? Because it didn't begin great from a standpoint of some of the stuff that was going on in the Djokovic camp didn't make Roger too happy with I think some of the family. I think it was a Monte Carlo match, one of their first matches, if not the first. How did that evolve over time, that rivalry?
You know, I always felt, not because of anything Roger ever said publicly, but I always felt there was more edge to that rivalry. I learned in reporting the book, you know, it's behind me, you know, The Warrior, which really looks at all of Nadal's career and goes deep on the rivalry, especially with Djokovic, that there was more angst behind the scenes with Roger and Rafa than I think I'd realized at the time when I was reporting, especially between the camps. I guess it's inevitable when you have that sort of jockeying for the number one spot. But the Djokovic thing, because of the way Novak and his family approached his ambition and approached his climb, and let's face it, I mean, Roger and Rafa did not face the kind of adversity that Novak did growing up, trying to find a way in the middle of a war-torn pariah nation to be able to find his way in a country that also had very little tennis heritage or background to draw from. So it's a very different scenario. And I think that those sort of worldviews and backstories kind of clashed in the case of Novak and Roger. And also, you know, Roger had adapted and adjusted to this, in my mind, the presence of Nadal and the reality of Nadal, which was not easy to accept, that this other world-class genius is there to play against him. And then suddenly Novak emerges. You know, the guy that Tony Nadal spotted at Wimbledon and said, Rafa, we've got a problem. I don't know for sure what, you know, what Paul Anacone or other people told Roger about Novak, but I imagine it was a similar kind of conversation, to be honest. I mean, just the ability that Novak possessed to change into the player he needed to be and the skill sets and the ball striking and everything else. I mean, clearly, I think those guys know, like nobody else knows, who the real threats are. But you're right. I thought there was always a bit more edge to it. Certainly, the proofs in the types of matches that Novak was able to win against Roger. I mean, three times in major important matches, U.S. Open semis twice and the Wimbledon final in 2019 to have two match points against him and be able to save them and beat Roger. I mean, who else did that? Nobody that I know. So I just think they matched up well. Roger's unpredictability, Djokovic's ability to lock down. But I think because of Novak didn't subscribe, in my view, at least as he was playing early in his career, to some of the same codes that Nadal and Federer subscribed to. He pushed it. He pushed the limits. I think he had legitimate physical issues to deal with, as was proven after he went gluten-free, and he also had operations, Novak did, for a deviated septum to help him with his breathing, but he was really struggling with his endurance, pulling out of matches, taking a lot of medical timeouts that I know, you know, angered a lot of his peers, including Roger early on in his career. But I think Roger would say to you now, and he said this to Novak, that I think maybe he misjudged Novak a little bit in terms of understanding where he was coming from and also understanding just the level of dedication that he had to their mutual craft. And I feel like they finished in a pretty good place. But for me, I'll always view that rivalry, which actually was a longer rivalry in terms of number of matches than the Federer-Nadal rivalry, as one that had a little more edge to it.
Chris Clary joining me here on the Tennis Worthy podcast. We know that those two other players will take their rightful place in the International Tennis Hall of Fame in due course as well. But this year is a celebration of Roger and what that means to tennis. And you talk about it quite a bit in your book about what's made him sort of this cultural icon that he is. You talk about him as a Swiss figure, neutral, diplomatic, multilingual. How much do you think that's affected sort of his status now as a, you know, it seems to me he's known more than just being an all-time great tennis player. He's almost like a cultural icon.
Yeah. I wrote in the book, ultimately it's not about, you know, the hard numbers. It's about the soft skills, I think, in a lot of ways for Roger and how he will live on in memory. And as I'm sure you have noticed from your ticket sales and you will notice this year as you guys honor him, it's a different level than I think any other player. And I say that with all respect to Nadal and to Djokovic. On a global level, Roger just hits certain chords, touches certain strings those guys don't reach. And, you know, for me, I thought a lot about it, obviously, covering him all those years. And when I tried to do the book, the best I could do it, I really wanted to be able to answer that question. You know, why? Why is there this such a strong connection that he's established? And I kind of centered in, I'd say, I think on three things. You know, one, there's just the pure aesthetic of it. You don't need to be a tennis player or even a regular tennis fan to watch Roger Federer play tennis and enjoy it and see the beauty and the movement and the stroke production. It's an elegant, flowing sort of thing. And, you know, I think it's something very elemental in the human condition to be able to appreciate that. And almost everybody did. The one-handed backhand certainly didn't hurt, but it was more than that. Roger always seemed to have a little bit of extra time to finish his shots. And interestingly, one of the things I learned when I wrote the book was that Peter Carter, who was the pivotal coach for him as a young man, Roger sort of copied his style in a lot of ways. And Peter Carter had the one-handed backhand. But the interesting thing, David McPherson told me this, was that Peter Carter, when he finished his shots, what did he do? He watched the contact point for a little, you know, microsecond after it was gone, which is Roger's signature, kind of like a top golfer, right? Watching the point of contact. And I think that defines him. Those sorts of little gestures and details really speak to people. Second thing was, I think, you know, Roger, for a great, great athlete and a great, great tennis player, there's no doubt, was often very vulnerable. He had some tough blows to absorb in the public eye, you know, from a pretty early age. You know, that match against Leighton Hewitt in Australia and Davis Cup early on, and then the defeat at Wimbledon after such a long run-up, and then the matches against Novak at the U.S. Open that he lost twice with the match points up, Del Potro final in 2009, and then of course, the match no one will ever forget who follows tennis, you know, the 2019 Wimbledon final when he had it right there and just couldn't quite close it. Very poignant. So I think seeing Roger, and then the Australian Open 2009 when Rafa beat him, and then Roger's "this is killing me" at the breaking down at the press conference after, I'm sorry, the ceremony. Those are all things that people noticed and saw, and they could see him going through this, and they could see him rise again. But his vulnerability, which you didn't often see when he was playing, he didn't show you a lot when he was playing. You saw it afterward. It was very human, and I think really spoke to people. And honestly, Patrick, you know, it's become a bit more a coin of the realm for male athletes to be so accessible with their emotions, maybe, but Roger's a big part of that. That scene we saw when he retired with Roger and Rafa sitting side by side, hands touching briefly, and then both breaking down. I mean, those are not typical male athlete sorts of moments at all. And I think Roger kind of redefined that. And I think he hit it right. I think his timing was good. He read the room, even though he didn't try to read it. I think his nature was sort of in tune with our times. And the third thing, of course, I'd say is the beauty of tennis is we get to see people up close for such a long period of time. But nobody was thinking of 15 to 20 years of dominance, really, when these guys emerged. And they were in our public eye for such a long time. People developed such deep connections to Roger, to Rafa, to Novak, even to players like Wawrinka, who didn't have the same consistent success, or Andy Murray. But Roger was there in the public eye, and really at a time when he was ready to be there, as we discussed already. He'd kind of worked through his demons, was able to, you know, present the player he wanted to be to the public most of the time. And I think those longevity, accessibility, emotionality, vulnerability, and just pure beauty. All those things are a unique cocktail to Roger and explain why he is who he is.
Chris Clary wrote The Master, story of Roger Federer. What from your standpoint, researching the book, Chris, was something maybe that you didn't know about?
Yeah, I mean, I think I didn't know to what degree he had suffered with his behavior early on. And one of the joys about doing that kind of book is, as a daily journalist, you're always on deadline writing about the current thing. Yes, you have time to delve into feature stories and go back, but to really like dig into the people that mattered to him, Peter Carter, his early coach, what made his path cross Roger's, in some ways very random, but so important for Roger's choice to become a tennis player and the player that he developed into, with his technique, his approach to the Aussies and the history of Australian tennis and connecting Roger to that past. I didn't know all that to that degree. And then to see what does Roger create with his celebrity and his sort of buying power, he creates the Laver Cup, a way to link to players of the past, an event you know better than I do, but certainly that was not a typical choice for a global superstar to use his capital for that, and he did, and there's a reason for that. It goes back to Peter Carter. And then Pierre Paganini, the other person who was so important, I think, in Rodgers' development as a player, his fitness trainer, who was part philosopher, part fitness trainer, and a guy who had no background really in tennis, which I didn't know until I did the book. He came out of a track and field background. His parents were musicians and teachers, not tennis players. But the fact that he came to the sport that we all know well with a different perspective and was able to bring that to Roger's training and break some of the, you know, molds and codes that applied to fitness training is a big reason why Roger was able to play and thrive for 20 years. So digging into Paganini's story and then digging into America's story, his wife, and sort of looking at her career and finding out, you know, how much she had to deal with and how Mirka was never going to be number one in the world, but Mirka could have been a, you know, top 20, consistent top 30 player with her internal drive, her ball striking ability. And she really had to deal with a foot injury that ended her career so young and channeled a lot of her ambition and a lot of her energy into helping Roger learn the lessons from that and be there for him as a rock in his corner. So I think one of the joys of the book was to get into Roger's career, but also the people who were part of his career, really understand where they were coming from.
Speaking of learning lessons, what would you say you learned from Roger Federer? Because I consider you, Chris, one of the most well-spoken, educated people that I know through the world of tennis, and I've been very happy to know you. You know, and I think from the all-time greats, we kind of learn something from them. What did you learn from Roger?
That's a great question. I appreciate your words, Patrick. That's nice of you to say that. You know what? I remember a conversation I had with Roger near the end of his career. He was coming back on clay, and I got the opportunity with the New York Times calling card to go spend some time with him in Switzerland as he trained on clay with Ivan Ljubicic and Severin Luti in this little village, you know, above a river and in the Alps near where he had his house in Lenzerheide. And he took me to lunch. So we went to lunch and we spent a couple hours. It was one of our longer interviews. And I was just talking about, you know, the keys to his longevity. And Roger used sort of the image of the closed fist. And he says, you cannot keep your fist closed for too long. You've got to find a way to let it go and decompress and relax. And one thing I really learned early in my career, and I think I did well, was I always found a way when I was at the point of being clenched for too long to find a way to get away from it, separate myself from the tour and those stresses, recharge my batteries, and then return. I always had an innate sense, he said, of when I needed to clench and unclench that fist. And honestly, in my very humble life, by comparison, and in my writing life and creative life, that's been an image that stuck with me. And I think it really applies to a lot of Roger and who he became and who he worked to become, is that he was able to understand how to be able to stay fresh in his head, in his body, in his relationships, all through this sport that can grind you down. I mean, I covered Pete Sampras, you know, all through his career as well. I was basically, you know, you and I are similar age group. I grew up covering you, all you guys, when I was about your age. So in that early years of my career. So I sort of saw that evolution, you know, with Pete in particular. And Pete was fried by 31. He didn't take energy from all the things in tennis that can drain you, like traveling and stuff like that, and just the relentless competition and all the conversations you have to have in the locker room and everywhere else. It wore him down, and it wears a lot of guys down. But Roger managed to beat that and not let that happen, partly because of his nature. He's a natural empath, somebody who's able to really pick up the energy in the room and adjust to it and thrive on it, but also because he just understood himself and came to understand himself when he needed to get away. And that meant, and maybe not being in the player hotel, or maybe not hanging around super long at the locker room beyond when he, you know, felt like he needed to, but he really listened to that internal voice and tried to, I think he loved tennis so much that he didn't want to burn out on it. And so he took the steps he needed to and understood them to avoid that. And certainly the game benefited from it.
Well, we benefited from this conversation. You and I could go on for hours.
It's true.
But for the good of the podcast, we'll end it there, Chris. You know, appreciate all the reporting you've done on tennis over the years, and But in this book, you really preserve the legacy of Roger. And I know you did that as well in the Rafa book. So can't wait to see what you have in store for us tennis fans next. And we appreciate all you've done and continue to do for the sport.
Patrick, thanks so much. It was always a pleasure covering you guys. And I appreciate all your insight over the years. You helped me out many times on tight deadlines. And I'll remember that. And I'll have an announcement for you guys, hopefully pretty soon, on what happens next in terms of books. I don't think it's going to be a big surprise.
Yeah, I'm sure that Christopher Clary, everyone, who many years was with the New York Times, now has his own Substack, so you can subscribe to that as well and look for his books in your local bookstore as well. It's a Tennis Worthy podcast here from the International Tennis Hall of Fame.